Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm glad to see, and I do see some familiar faces here, that's always nice. I'm glad to see so many people here. I know we're up against, I think, 8 other sessions. So I appreciate y'all being here this morning. And we're going to try to keep this a little bit informal. We have, let me tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to go through and kind of present an overview of rapid ethnographic assessment, and then we're going to have 2 other presentations that will talk about first methods and then analysis. But before we get started, I want to kind of do some brief introductions of myself and my colleagues who are up here. My name is Karen Kroger, and I'm a research anthropologist at the Division of STD Prevention at CDC. And I've been working on qualitative research methods in rapid ethnographic assessment for about 10 years now, in various capacities, first in the Global AIDS program, first as an anthropologist in the field, then in the Global AIDS program at CDC, and now in the Division of STD Prevention. And the division has actually used this approach for a good long while, longer than, I think a couple of decades. So we're always glad to talk about it and let people know how it can be used in programs and its various benefits. Maybe I can just ask my colleagues to introduce themselves briefly. So, Thurka.
Hi, my name is Thurka Sengar-Morthy. I'm also a medical anthropologist. I am currently a fellow in the Office of the Director of the National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention at the CDC.
Hi, I'm Fred Bloom. I'm currently I'm a medical anthropologist as well. Currently I work as the Deputy Associate Director for Science for STD in the in the director's office, and I used to do the same kind of work Karen did in doing ethnographic assessments for STD, increases in infection and things like that.
And I also want to acknowledge our colleague who is in the audience here, Carla Alexander Pender, who was in the CDC field program for a number of years. How many years, Carla?
8
years. And she just recently joined our team at CDC and is going to be working on rapid assessment with us. So she brings a set of skills that are going to be very, very helpful in terms of she's got the very grounded field experience. And so her set of skills and her knowledge base is going to be really helpful to us in carrying out rapid assessments. So I just want to acknowledge Carla.
Hello.
Okay. As I said earlier, we're going to go through the presentations. We're going to do some practice in the second 2 modules, and we want, as we go through this, we're going to try and keep things moving pretty quickly because we've only got an hour and, I think, 45 minutes. But we also want to be able to save some time for questions. So, first of all, this is a definition from James Beebe, who is an anthropologist who has been doing rapid assessment, what he calls rapid assessment process, for a number of years. And the definition he uses is that rapid assessment is an intensive, team-based, qualitative inquiry using triangulation and iterative data collection and analysis to quickly develop an understanding of a situation from the insider's perspective. And those words in yellow, as we go through the presentation and the exercises, you'll see how those become important. Those are kind of key concepts that ground rapid assessment. So the idea that it's very team-based, it's based in qualitative methods, that you're triangulating across data sources and often across methods, and there's an iterative process, and that you're really focused on getting the insider's perspective, which is really key. So rapid assessment is actually, I have a lot of people ask me, you know, is rapid assessment the same as program assessment? Is rapid assessment the same as evaluation? Rapid assessment is really what I call an approach to data collection for a variety of purposes. So it can be used for exploratory research, for formative research, to do needs assessment, to do program assessment, and to formulate rapid response. if you were in the plenary session just a few minutes ago and Kevin Cranston talked about the evaluation that was done in Massachusetts to look at the impact of the closing of STD clinics on DIS work patterns and the provision of services, that was actually done, he referred to that as an evaluation, but it was actually done using a rapid assessment approach. It's based primarily in qualitative methods, so in-depth interviews, focus groups, mapping, and not only mapping in terms of GIS and electronic mapping that is available to us nowadays, but what we call ethnographic mapping, where you actually have people in the field draw maps or identify hotspots and actually do, you know, visualizations of what might be going on in a geographic area. And those can be very useful. It also includes methods like observation, which Thurka will talk about, and then sometimes some rapid assessments you actually use street intercept surveys, so very brief surveys where you stop someone on the street and ask them a few questions. As I said, it's team-based, and that's very important. It's based on small non-probability samples. And that is because if you're familiar, and maybe you could just, I could just see a show of hands of how many folks in the room have actually have any experience with or have used qualitative methods in the past. Okay, so you know, so some of you know that qualitative methods are really focused on purposive samples, samples for variables of interest where you're interviewing, you're selecting samples based on particular characteristics, not necessarily randomly, and based on ethnographic principles. Just to give you a little bit of the background of rapid assessment, rapid ethnographic assessment emerged in international health and development, as far as we can tell, in the 1970s, and tended to show up in low-resource settings in, you know, countries in Africa where there was a need for rapid response to solve public health problems like diarrheal disease, water safety, those kinds of things. And where there were few resources and few existing data. And there was also a need to engage a community in helping to formulate a solution. And I think, you know, with exception, perhaps the only exception being that nowadays in this country, you know, we have a lot of data, those other characteristics kind of ring true for us now. You know, short on resources, need to have a rapid turnaround, need to have a community engaged in formulating a solution. Just there, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this, you know, there are many, many rapid assessment tools and protocols that have been developed over the years that go by many different names, and they do vary in terms of the methods that are incorporated, how structured the protocols are, what the research questions have been, but they all of these kind of incorporate at their core the basic principles of rapid assessment, team-based qualitative inquiry. Now, what makes something ethnographic? We talk about ethnography as the study of a group of people with shared characteristics in their natural settings. Ethnography kind of comes out of the field of anthropology, where anthropologists had traditionally spent a long time in the field learning about the community and the culture that they were in. Anthropologists typically spend at least a year in the field doing their field work. And ethnography is focused on, you know, generating a cultural portrait based on observations and listening to the voices of informants. So spending a lot of time in the field talking to people who are there about what's going on. When we talk about culture, you know, even though this is a term that comes out of anthropology, when we talk about culture, culture is broader than, you know, religion, art, material culture. It's really, we're talking about shared beliefs, practices, vocabularies, and values. And so this can be ethnic, it can be religious, it can be professional, it could be institutional culture. And I'm, you know, we'll come show you some examples of what we mean by that. So qualitative methods, and you know, obviously there are some of you in the room that have experience with this, you already know, are oriented toward describing rather than enumerating, looking for meaning or insight rather than proof, learning from rather than studying people, And I think that's a particularly important point. When I work with people at CDC and in the field who don't have experience with qualitative methods, who are more oriented toward using quantitative methods, and most of their training has been in quantitative methods, this kind of shift in orientation to getting inside the person that you are talking to or listening to's head, trying to understand where they're coming from, learning from the way they talk about things, the way they construct stories, the way they reveal what is important to them, is different than just than going after a particular answer. So it's a different kind of orientation, and I think that sometimes takes a little bit of getting used to for people. We're looking for patterns and how things connect, and again, that concept of culture, using that concept of culture to frame results. How are we doing it? So we use rapid assessment when we need to explore a topic, when we have few data available or we don't know or we're just trying to find out about something. As we said before, when there are few other available data, when you don't have data that can explain what it is that you're seeing, when you want depth rather than breadth, and I think that's a really important point as well. Rapid assessments, the goal of qualitative research methods is to obtain depth and description as opposed to taking the broad view of things. When we need to provide rapid feedback, the strength of rapid assessment is that the goal is to get out, get the data, get it back, get a report. It's very practical to get that information back to your policymakers or your program managers. Another reason to use rapid assessment is that when telling this story from the inside or from the local perspective is going to be more persuasive. And sometimes we tend to forget about that, but if you think about how you need to influence policymakers, you know, data are really important, but it's not just the quantitative data, it's the stories, it's the quotes, it's the revealed experiences of people in the field about what kinds of situations they're running into or what kinds of difficulties they're facing. And that can be having that story told in the words of the people who are actually experiencing those challenges or those kinds of situations is really powerful sometimes. Some of the types of findings in rapid assessment and in qualitative data in general is, you know, what, why, the kinds of things that you're looking for is, as opposed to how many, is what, how, and why things are occurring. Things like lists and categories, typologies and terminology, which might be really important. If you think about, you might be using rapid assessment to do some formative work that would then feed into a survey, and you need to know the terminology that people are using. That you're going to be conducting your study with or your survey with. That's one example of how that might be used. People's experiences and perspectives, how they feel about things, what they, you know, as we've said before, what kinds of situations they're running into, motivations and values, and then unexpected findings. And we don't often think about unexpected findings as something that you go out necessarily to look for, but a lot of times in a rapid assessment, it's not uncommon to actually come across information or to uncover information that may be very useful in your program. Now, you wouldn't go out and do a rapid assessment to try to find unexpected findings, but those findings can be really important. And a couple of examples are, you know, if you think about years ago, injecting drug users, where we were doing a lot of work with injecting drug users about cleaning their work, or about not sharing their needles. And we had gotten that message across pretty well, but we were still seeing disease being transmitted. And we went out and did more ethnography around that and learned that really what they were doing was sharing cotton and sharing cookers, but they weren't sharing needles. So that's a really important piece of information, and I think no one really expected that, but they found that. Another thing that we found a couple of times, actually, in our STD programs is when we're doing rapid assessments in the field is that sex workers have been and are being arrested by police in jurisdictions for carrying condoms. So sex workers may be working on the street, and they may be reluctant to carry condoms. When we first heard this, we were really surprised. police will arrest them if they carry more than two condoms. That's a really important piece of information. It's a very small piece of information, totally unexpected, at least initially when we heard it. Now we sort of know to ask for that. But you know, very important information to give back to the program so that they can do the necessary work to get that stopped. So list typologies, categories, and terminology. You know, just an example, this is from Cambodia. Yama, you know, is a local term. You can get the, you know, just an example of the list of the different ways drugs were used, other drugs used, different kinds of terms and categories that may be very useful. Let's see, go back up a minute. Okay. This is actually from a rapid assessment that we did a couple of years ago in North Carolina, where we were really interested in trying to understand more about mobility patterns among female sex workers who were providing services to Latino migrant men. We did this with a small number of interviews, but what this work allowed us to do was to get kind of a first preliminary understanding of the organization of mobility patterns, the different kinds of sex workers that were working, that were providing services to migrant men, the different venues in which they were meeting, the types of venues, and then the mobility patterns. And I won't go into a long explanation of this, but what this allowed us to do was to basically look at patterns and then make some recommendations, cautious recommendations, around where the priorities might need to be. And if you think about it, you know, one of the things that we saw from doing this was that the more urban-based and peri-urban-based migrant workers, who were not necessarily farm workers, were probably, or it looked to be, at somewhat higher risk because of the particular groups of sex workers that they were interacting with and the variety of venues. Whereas a lot of our resources and a lot of our activities are centered around migrant farm workers who are at camps because they're easy to reach. And so I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing those interventions or we shouldn't have those interventions with migrant farm workers in camps, but I think this showed us that there might be some need to address the needs of farm workers who are not in camps, who are in these more residential areas. What people do, just another example of, you know, explanation of showing where, you know, how people use, dispose of their or store their drug using equipment. You can use photographs in rapid assessments. We've done that. We've started to do that more recently. This is an example. This is actually from a rapid assessment that we did in Maricopa County, Arizona, and is an illustration of, I think, motivations or institutional culture. We were actually looking into factors contributing to congenital syphilis cases among Latinas in Maricopa County, and this was from an interview with a clinician, an ER doc, who basically said, you know, sure, we'd like to help you, but we're not going to do a syphilis test in an ER setting. That's not our priority. That's a really good example of institutional or professional culture. His values are around being very fast, being very efficient, and being able to identify life-threatening emergencies as opposed to STDs. So, you know, this is, I think, you know, one of the things you learn is sort of how people, what people's worldviews are, how they frame what's important to them as opposed to what's not important. Okay. Very briefly, some strengths and challenges. One of the strengths of rapid assessments is that compared to a lot of other research methodologies or approaches, they are relatively low cost, and I'll give you a couple examples in a moment here. They result, as we said, they can be very, and ideally are rapid. You get into the field, you get back, you do the data analysis, and you've got timely data rather than data that is from over a, you know, a two-year period. Timely is, and rapid is relative. I've been involved in rapid assessments that were not at all rapid, and that really defeats the purpose. So we try to keep them, and the ideal is to try to keep them efficient and get the results back quickly. As we said, recommendations stem from local realities. You're working at a local level and interviewing people at the local level, whatever that may be, based on your research question. So your recommendations are, by and large, going to be grounded in what's happening at a local level. So they're going to be more practical. And we've been, I think, working really hard at CDC and trying to make them even more practical with each of the rapid assessments that we do. We talked about engaging policymakers, engaging local community and target populations. I worked on rapid assessments that have ranged from very small assessments where we've gone out and talked mainly to providers because they're very easy for us to get access to, but I've also worked on rapid assessments that have been larger scale. And in ideal circumstances, you are involving and engaging people within the target community, the affected community, in data collection. So they can be a really important capacity building tool. I've worked on rapid assessments where we recruited, as part of our data collection team and our planning team, current and former people who use drugs and sex workers. Those people have access to hidden populations of people that we can't necessarily get to. This also increases the amount of engagement and investment in whatever interventions or activities that you plan subsequent to the rapid assessment. Now, challenges, obvious challenges, it does not show magnitude. People will ask you, well, how big is that problem? How many people said that? Okay, fine, this is all very interesting. What else can you tell me about how many, you know, how big this problem is? It's not going to tell you that. It's not meant to tell you that. It can point you in the direction of some additional questions, but, you know, it's not meant to show magnitude. The other challenge is that expertise in qualitative methods is relatively, there are very relatively few people in public health working in qualitative methods. I think there are a bunch of them in this room, you know, but if you think about how big this convention or this conference is and how many people are here, it's a relatively small proportion. So it does require a little bit of qualitative expertise, but I think the beauty of it is that you don't need a lot to be able to use the methods well. Okay, a couple of examples, and I don't know, you probably can't see this very well, unfortunately, but small and large scale rapid assessments. Okay, time to go. Okay. Small and large large scale rapid assessments, as I mentioned before, we've been working on small scale rapid assessments in the division where we go out and interview providers and people from community-based organizations. And the first two examples, one is from Maricopa County, Arizona, and the other is from North Carolina, where we were in a very small area, geographic area. So in Maricopa County in Phoenix, and in North Carolina, we were in a four-county area. We did a small number of interviews, 42 interviews, key informant interviews with providers in Maricopa County, and even less than that in North Carolina. Those rapid assessments were not very expensive. The cost was $6,000 for each of those, and that was basically travel cost to get the rapid assessment team in the field. In contrast, this rapid assessment that I mentioned earlier in South Africa was a rapid assessment that took place in three sites with three different populations, three different cities, in multiple sites in three different cities. But even so, and we did 151 key informant interviews, we did focus groups, mapping. It was very, very extensive. But even so, the budget for that project, and this was about 4 years ago, I think, was $250,000. So if you think about that in comparison to, you know, some of the behavioral surveys that may cost in the millions, it's still a relatively low cost approach. So some considerations, and I think this is my last slide. Just to think about rapid assessment, some considerations before you go in, and these are some things just that I've learned from working with people carrying out smaller and larger rapid assessments, that you really need to think about whether this is the right approach for the question. And I think sometimes people are attracted to this methodology, but they're not using it to answer the right questions. And so you have to really think that through and think about what your questions are and can they really be answered by rapid assessment. Do you have data already that would answer that question in another way, or can that question be answered in another way using a different methodology? And those are some of the things you want to ask first. The other question is obviously is how big should it be, small scale or multi-site? And I think the other pitfall that I've seen people fall into is the desire to ask so many questions or to interview so many people that they lose the depth and the meat. So, you know, the idea that, well, I can go out and add another site, or I can add 40 more interviews, or I can, you know, add another target group. You know, you really have to weigh the need for depth with the desire for breadth, because depth is really what you're going after here. You have to build in enough time to do good field work, and Thurka and Fred are both going to talk about field work. Field work is really important, and being in the field and doing good, solid field work is essential. It's different. This is very different. There needs to be continuity between your field work and your analysis. This is very different from doing a survey where you send a team out to collect data through a survey instrument, and then those surveys come back and somebody else analyzes them. In rapid assessment, you really want continuity between the data collection teams and the analysis team. Some of the other questions, you know, how are you going to handle those data, written notes, are you going to record, do you need to translate? And then finally, who's going to analyze the data? And the one point that I always like to emphasize is that qualitative, and sometimes people are surprised to hear this, qualitative data analysis software does not do the analysis for you. Every interview that you collect, you need to read. So, you know, if you're going to collect 300 interviews, you're going to be reading those 300 interviews. And, you know, there are strategies for reducing data and all of that, but it's a very different process from doing surveys. And then, of course, your budget, which we all know is probably the first, should be the first bullet. So I think, do we have just a couple minutes for questions? Okay. We have a couple of minutes for questions, but we'll also have time at the end for questions.
So you mentioned that you have to have some experience with qualitative methods to do this appropriately. And I know that a while back you had trained some of my folks in a different unit to, you know, kind of beef up their community needs assessment at least, you know, you didn't teach them RAP. How long does it take to train, you know, let's say master's level folks to, you know, do it reliably? We're not saying perfectly, but to avoid the big mistakes. Can you do that rapidly?
Yes. Yes, you can. And usually what I like to do is, if we have the opportunity to do it, is to do a good training on skills, interviewing skills, and then also do a training on the interview guide. So once you have the guide, you know, to actually be able to spend time training people. Now, what we've been doing in the division is actually bringing people in who are PHPS fellows and other fellows across CDC, and basically pushing people out to the field to start doing some of this work. We give them a little bit of preparation, probably not enough, and not as much as we would like to. But one of the things we've been able to do is try to pick out who will be, and people have an opportunity to learn, you know, are they going to be a good interviewer, or are they going to be a better note taker? Because those are different skill sets. I would say that you can get, in our experience in South Africa, we put people through a week-long training, which was, when this was a big project. So a week-long training, we had some people who were very good interviewers after the first day or two in the field, based on that training. We had other people who were just not ever going to be good interviewers. So those are skill sets, and I think one of the things you learn when you're doing rapid assessment consistently is, you know, how to hire the people that have the right skill sets. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have to have a master's with a lot of training in qualitative research methods. Having had some experience helps. And I think, you know, giving people an opportunity to use those skills and develop those skills is really important. Because you can talk about it, but until you've actually done an interview, you've gone out and interviewed people, you don't really know what that's like. One more.
Hi. I'm wondering, how do you mobilize and go out rapidly if you need something like an IRB? Because it seems like some of this stuff would require IRB approval, but that doesn't oftentimes happen rapidly.
Right. That is, I mean, you have to have your IRB. If you're going to be required to go through IRB for your rapid assessment, you've got to have that in place before you get into the field. So you can do your planning, get your IRB process in place and your approvals, and then get into the field and do your data collection and analysis quickly. So the rapid assessment, the process of actually getting into the field to do the data collection and an analysis will be more rapid. But you're right. I mean, the IRB process could take a long time. Now, we, and Fred can speak more to this, we've in the division actually do for our partners at the state and local level, we do this as provision of technical assistance. So at the request of the state, we can go out and collect data as part of rapid public health response. And we do a request for determination of non-research is a much more expedited process. And so it really kind of depends upon where you're doing the rapid assessment, who you're doing it for, and who your partners are. So I think you want to respond to that.
Yeah, as far as the IRB requirements, if you're a state, county, federal health department and you are doing rapid assessment as a way to run your program to see what's going on, it's very much like evaluation, and it is not required to go through an IRB in general. If there's ever a specific question, you can always ask, but in general, you don't need an IRB to go out and find out what's going on, why your disease rates are going up. It's just a systematized way of doing what a lot of you already do. One of the main drivers that we found for going ahead and getting it into an IRB was that we can't publish our findings without having it go through an IRB, because even when you cite them the Code of Federal Regulations from 45 CFR 46, if you're familiar with that on human subjects regulations, no matter what you do, some of the journals say that if you're going to publish it, you have to have an IRB ethics review. So that's partly what drove us to do it. But if you're actually doing it as part of your program, you usually don't need an IRB.
Okay, so I'm going to speak a little bit about methods today. So as Karen outlined, there are lots of different methods for it, but we are restricted in terms of time, so I'm going to focus basically on two, ethnographic observation and interviews, and we're going to take you through some interactive exercises to kind of, for you to sort of see what we mean by these. And I'm also going to emphasize the importance of field notes in both of these methods. So ethnographic observation, does anyone want to take a stab at what that is? I think that's a really good way to put it. It's studying people in their own environment where they live, work, and play. It's about watching very intently what's happening, and it's also about listening very intently to what people say. And, you know, you might say, well, we do this all the time. This is part of my job. This is part of what I do on a daily basis. But ethnographic observation in the field actually requires more than just looking, listening, and actually taking notes on what you're seeing. It's a very focused and a very structured way of seeing and listening to what's going on in an environment.
And the purpose is to really gain an understanding of context in which people live, the relationships within this context. And it doesn't necessarily mean just relationships between people. It's also about relationships between people and things, people and places. And it's also about behaviors and activities that occur within a context. And observation also allows us to learn what it's like to be an insider while still being an outsider. And what you're going to hear this is sort of a running theme in rapid ethnographic assessment. And what this really means is that oftentimes we look at a scene, so for instance, just looking around the room, you know, sort of very everyday kind of mundane kinds of things that we go through. And oftentimes we're so embedded in the scene that it's just sort of a natural part of everyday being. But to actually look at it as if you were looking at it for the first time, those are the things that you're looking when you're looking to observe, to see everything as if it were new for the first time, actually to record the color of the chairs, the number of people, what each person looks like. So those are the things that you're really trying to hone in on when you're doing ethnographic observation. So what to observe? So here is a scene from Times Square, and I just want you to kind of imagine yourself just standing right there. And this, you know, it's kind of an overload on the senses, so to speak. But oftentimes, even in the most basic settings, you need to kind of pay attention to a lot of different things that are going on. So there are many things that you can observe here. You know, there are characteristics of participants, there are interactions going on, there are relationships between participants, there are lots of nonverbal behavior that you could observe, physical surroundings, and also a lot of products. We often don't think about products as being things that you observe, but there are, you know, things like billboards, a lot of social media, web pages, reports, brochures, all of those things are things you can also observe as well in a setting. So some basics in terms of the nitty-gritty of observation. Where you observe or where to observe things really depends on what it is that you're looking to find out. For example, you know, researchers really need to be prepared to adapt to a variety of settings and to observe and interact with people as they engage in activities in a natural environment. So outside very typically controlled research settings like bars, like streets, like homes, parks, a lot of social venues. So some of the examples that have where we've done observation are high-risk sexual activity venues, clinics, waiting rooms, town hall meetings. So all of these things you can pretty much observe, do ethnographic observation. And it skipped one. Okay, sorry. observations can be scheduled any time during research, but you really need to be flexible. So for instance, if you hear that, you know, certain young people are meeting at the club, engaging in high-risk sexual behavior on Saturday nights, then you need to actually go to the club on a Saturday night to figure out what it is going on. And so if you go, for instance, Tuesday during the day, Tuesday night, it's not necessarily where things are happening. So you really need to be flexible. You really need to kind of go outside regularly scheduled times to really do good observation. Observation can be done by individuals or in teams as appropriate. It really depends on the setting. And oftentimes when you do observation, you have to have this delicate balance where you're present really needs to be discreet enough not to interrupt the observed environment. So you're not, for instance, you know, sitting there with your notepad and your pen at a club, you know, taking notes. So you really need to kind of blend into the setting, but you need to be open enough not to compromise participants' privacy. So you do kind of need to let people know what it is that you're doing and why you're there. And in rapid ethnographic assessment, we kind of go by the rule around person, place, and time. So it really, a lot of where observation takes place, it really is dependent on the people that you want to learn more about, the places in which they hang out and do the activities that you're interested in, and also the various different times where these activities are actually occurring. So there's several advantages. You get great insight into context, into relationships, into behavior. You're able to provide information that might be unexpected or unknown. Some of the things that Karen talked about earlier can be really done through observation. And you can also compare observational data with other types of data. For instance, interview notes, interview data, surveys, mapping, focus groups. There are some challenges. As you can probably tell, it's very time-consuming. It takes a lot of time, especially if you're looking at different things at different times of the day, at different periods of time. It can be time-consuming. And the documentation, actually getting observational data, really is very dependent on the researcher's memory. And we'll talk a little bit about that when I talk about field notes, on your observational skills, again, to sort of see settings as if you were looking at it for the very first time. And it's also about your sensitivity, again, trying to think through things as if you were seeing it for the first time. So a lot of that depends on the researcher. So field notes. Field notes are data that document what you experienced, what you learned through interaction with others, and what you observed. And it doesn't necessarily just have to be written notes or typed notes. They can include sketches, photos, diagrams. Anything is really part of field notes. And the most important thing about field notes is that they need to be expanded off-site as soon as possible. And you really need to schedule the time to do this. So, for instance, if you are, say, at a club or a bar or even on the street corner, taking some notes, doing some observation, oftentimes you can't necessarily sit there with a pen and paper to take your notes or even with your laptop. And so you need to take some really important, very sort of on-the-spot mental notes. You really need to kind of do that and then schedule a lot of time as soon as you can and as soon as you're able to come back, write a few things down perhaps, and then to really expand on those notes. And field notes really need to be very holistic. They really need to sort of tell a story. They need to be a descriptive narrative. And I can't emphasize that details are very, very important. Oftentimes we get sort of bullet points, and that's really not the goal of field notes. They really need to sort of be much richer. They really need to sort of tell a story. And so I want to give you an example of this. This is the rapid ethnographic assessment that we did in North Carolina that Karen talked about with sex workers and farm workers. And we had heard through some of our initial interviews that there is a subset of farm workers who hold H-2A visas, and they are living in sort of much more controlled environments within the farms. But there are many more farm workers who don't have H-2A visas, and they live in sort of the periphery in various different types of structures. And so this was on one of our observational sort of drives where we went around and tried to find some of these places where a lot of the undocumented workers were. And this was a structure that was pretty much falling apart, kind of caving in on itself. And I don't know if you're able to sort of see the inside of it over there. We took some pictures, and here are, I kind of typed up some of my notes. And I want to kind of just give you an example of what field notes should look like. So I just want to kind of read this. We made a left and drove for about 5 to 10 minutes when we spotted a small farm with a sign that said no occupancy under its name. We saw several cars parked there but didn't see anyone on site. Directly across the road from the farm, we saw a shed that looked as if it were in bad shape. We were able to see two mattresses propped up against the wall and a lot of garbage. There was a pathway leading to farm fields nearby. The shed looked as if it were collapsing, and I couldn't tell where the ground was because the weeds in front of the shed were really tall. They reached higher than my knees the closer I got to the shed, and when I couldn't see the ground anymore, I didn't want to keep going. I couldn't tell if it was recently occupied or not. So instead of sort of bullet points around, you know, shed collapsing, two mattresses, these are sort of, this is a much more holistic picture of what I saw and my feelings around being around the shed. So these are the types of notes that you want to have when you write field notes. And so we did have this YouTube video. This is sort of the interactive portion of this where we wanted to kind of show you a video and actually take you through doing observation, but we're not connected to the internet in these rooms and we couldn't download the video. So what we're gonna do, is actually take you back to this picture of Times Square and have you write some expanded field notes just for about 3 or 4 minutes, just to kind of give you an idea of how to do this, to get into practice of doing this. So just imagine yourself right there, right at that corner of Times Square, and just take a couple of minutes to write down some field notes, and we'll do a debriefing very quickly after a few minutes.
Yeah, that's what I did too, but I just logged on to the Minneapolis public site. Well, we didn't want to take the thing down and put it up, because it just didn't. If we'd have done it earlier, we probably could have, but.
I just realized that.
Yeah.
So I know that interview, and then the interview
is about to start. Okay. If anybody else wants to come up and take a closer look, feel free.
No, we don't.
We'll use a microphone, though.
Can I take
it?
Yeah,
just.
Can I take this out of here? She's wired. Oh. Yeah. I might take that.
You can use that one.
So what are some of the, we're just going to keep moving since we have very limited time. So what are some of the things that some of you wrote down.
There were many taxis and buses along the street.
Okay, so a lot of around sort of transportation.
And then a big walking area with a lot of people going both directions and a variety of races.
Okay, so and then there's also a walkway where people are walking both going away and coming over as well. I'm sorry? Yes, there's also people who are sitting in various positions as well. Right, and so a lot of one of the things that I think is really interesting about this that you caught on to is a lot of the advertisements and a lot of the signs, and those are really, really important to pay attention to here.
And actually shows
up
the 1500 block.
Right, right. And so what might some of those things kind of tell you about this place if you didn't know that this was Times Square? Right, so you can tell what season it is by what people are saying, what people are wearing. What might some of the signs kind of tell you about this place?
What I see is I saw a bustling urban center, lots of excitement, people coming and going, and lots of things to do here. A great place for a terrorist to attack.
Okay. So, bustling entertainment center, very exciting, where things are happening. People are constantly moving. There's just a lot of movement here.
Also, the signs mean, usually when I look at the advertisement, signs means it's a very busy street.
Very busy street. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have something?
Yeah, I would just say tourist.
It's a touristy place as well.
Yeah.
Right. And one more before we.
The first thing I noticed, the tall buildings, and then as my eyes came down and I saw all the people, the vehicles, and I could smell the exhaust and the noise.
Right, and this is pollution. Just sort of again, some of the characteristics of a very urban environment, buildings.
There's also an absence of private vehicles.
Also an absence of private vehicles. And this is a really good point. It's also what it is, but what it isn't as well. And that's also a really important part of observation. You guys did really, that was really great. Okay, so I'm going to move on to in-depth interviews. And so what are in-depth interviews? They're one-on-one in-depth discussions to explore perceptions and understandings of problems, behaviors, and barriers. They also are meant to elicit individual experiences, opinions, feelings, general lifestyle, and everyday needs. And in thinking about this, there are certain goals that the interviewer has, and it's really to create a very intimate, personalized atmosphere where the interviewer and the participant can discuss personal issues and struggles. And so the goal of the interview here is to really elicit stories. Again, to really get the person to talk from participants by posing open-ended questions, and we'll look at a few examples of what I mean by open-ended questions. It's to really listen, and I know I can't emphasize that enough. It's really important to listen in ethnographic interviewing. It's a skill that you really need to develop. And to really listen enough to ask follow-up questions based on the responses that you're hearing. So you're often not thinking about the next question that you're going to ask, but to actually really listen to what the person is saying and to be able to come up with follow-up or probing questions that are very much dependent on what the person is saying. So that's why you really need to be listening. And so the skills needed for an interviewer is to really have the ability to build rapport, again, to create this sort of positive, a very relaxed environment. And this is really important. It's the ability to treat the participant as the expert, to actually go in there thinking that you don't really know very much. You know a little bit, but to actually think and to believe and make the person feel like they are the expert, because they are. And the ability to adapt to different personalities, that's also very important. And participants are those, you want to pick participants for in-depth interviews who have experience and knowledge of the research subject, who are able to talk about key issues of interest, and who represent a range of individuals in the community being studied. So it can be providers, it can be community leaders, it can be at-risk individuals, it can be a variety, and you want to have a variety of different people that you want to talk to if you are able to do that. And so a few key things to remember in terms of effective interviewing. Remember to ask one question at a time. That's really important. I know it sort of sounds basic, but sometimes just one question can give you all the information that you really need. So to really ask one question at a time. To, again, verify and expand unclear answers using probes or follow-ups. So things like, can you please elaborate on this, or can you give me an example of X? What do you mean when you say X? Ask open-ended questions. So instead of saying, does X relate to Y, which would kind of elicit a yes or no response or sort of one-worded responses, you would ask very open-ended questions, things like, how would you describe this? Or what are your thoughts on this? Don't ask leading questions. I think this is another thing that people have a hard time doing. So when you ask something like, do you think parents don't talk about sex and condoms because they're too embarrassed? I mean, it seems a little innocuous, but this is a very leading question. First of all, you're assuming that parents don't talk about sex and condoms, but then you're also assuming that they're too embarrassed, and that's why they don't talk about it. So instead of saying something like that, you might want to formulate a question in an open-ended way, which would be, how do parents talk about sex? Might be a better way to ask that question. You want to have a semi-structured interview guide. A few pre-structured list of questions that guide the flow of the conversation, but the discussion really remains unstructured, so you're able to talk about opinions and attitudes in a very unrestricted way. So I want to give you examples of some questions that we asked, again, in the North Carolina Rapid Ethnographic Assessment. And the first question is really what we call a lead question, not a leading question, but the question that you want to start off with. And this one is kind of meant to gather as much information as possible. So what can you tell us about sex work in this area? What are your thoughts about sex work in this area? And some of the probing questions, depending on what the person is saying, is how prevalent, how visible, how common is sex work in this area? Where does sex work take place in this area? Have there been recent changes? What kind of changes have you noticed? So again, it's really ethnographic interviewing really requires you to ask questions in a different way. Again, the same applies for field notes, but for interviews, you really do need to take notes during interviews. Even if you're recording the interview, even if you have someone who's taking notes for you, it's really important for you to take notes to document a lot of nonverbal behavior, a lot of reactions to certain questions, and just your own thoughts on what the person is saying that you can, contribute to writing of the notes. Sometimes it might just be you, but sometimes, hopefully, you will have someone else who will be taking notes with you, and it's really helpful. So we want to do our last sort of exercise, and Fred will take you through analyzing this, is to pair up with one other person that you're sitting next to and just to sort of decide on who's going to interview and who's not, who's going to actually be the respondent, and to interview a person in about, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. Is that enough? 3 or 4 minutes. And ask the person, tell me about the most memorable travel experience that you've ever had. And Fred will take you through analyzing your interview data. Thanks.
And if there's two people, make sure there's two people. If you have three people, one of you could take notes, one could interview, and one could talk. And decide between yourself who's a good interview, who's a good talker.
Who's a good note taker.
And who's a good note taker if you've got three? Great, and we're available to come up there too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, try to take about one more minute and then we'll start. Okay. Hopefully you've just about finished. I think we'll get started. Okay, I'll just start. If you have to keep going, you can. Okay, so what we're going to talk about now is debriefing. It's actually a little bit part of your methods and part of your analysis, and Karen has mentioned that. One of the first things that you want to remember, and I don't know if it was clear when we started, but you want to remember what the purpose of your rapid assessment is when you go out. Sometimes people sort of forget as you're sort of getting more and more information, and you find this unexpected information. You sometimes start following up on that and forget, oh, gosh, we really did have another purpose that had to be met as well as the unexpected information. So anyway, the purpose of this, of course, was to find out about travel. So one of the things we're going to be doing, the first thing we're going to be doing is debriefing, sort of expanding and clarifying the data. What this does is this helps you with validation of interview data. So what you're doing is you're gonna. Whoever took notes will be, will do this as a group. But normally, what you might do is, if you had a note taker and an interviewer, you would the interviewer could read over the notes and then ask the note taker more questions about what they heard in the interview. Because a lot of times, if you're concentrating on doing the interview, you don't hear as well, no matter how hard you listen. So it's always nice to have that second part, you know, pair of ears. Same thing, you know, you could go either direction. The interview could ask the note taker could ask the interviewer to expand notes. Another thing that you can do as sort of an iterative process as you go on and on through your data collection is to validate your data is to go ahead and talk to the next person and say, add in some additional questions. Is, you know, we already heard about this thing about the police, you know, arresting people for having three condoms in their pocket. What's that about? You know, and you can start following up on that sort of thing. Or we heard this, and what you know, we've heard two different things, and why do you think we're hearing two different things? So you can actually validate with the next person. Another way you can do it that we do pretty often is with a draft report. So as soon as you get back to, you know, where you can write up all your findings and get out a just some sort of summary of report, pull together a presentation, call a town hall meeting, get as many of the people that you might have interviewed or people in the community that you're working with, and get them together and say, this is what we found, what does everyone think, and you can get a lot of additional information to then put into a final report. So, for our group exercise, we're just going to go ahead and sort of do a group debriefing and expand and validate our travel interviews. So, yeah. So, three things that we're going to be looking at as far as looking at the data. The first is facts. From anytime you're doing interviews, you're going to be getting facts. What does this person do? So say you're interviewing somebody at a CBO who works with the migrant Latino health farmers in the migrant Latino farmers in North Carolina. And you're going to ask them a lot of questions. You're going to get a lot of facts. How many people do you serve? What countries do they come from? We're a little early. I have to go this slide, and then you'll end up ready. Lots of that kind of stuff. What venues do they go to? Are they using condoms? What kind of frequency and pattern are you seeing with those condoms? Because a lot of this, you want to have a real good picture of what's going on in this ethnographic project you're doing. You can sort of see ethnography has been described as a snapshot in time, both for good and for bad. So what you get is you get a really in-depth picture of a very specific group of people and a very specific group of behaviors and situations and products at a particular time. 3 days later, a month later, 3 months later, things have changed. That doesn't say you can't use it, but it's something to consider. So you want all these facts that will sort of help give you some background on what you're working in. One of the most interesting things you're going to find are themes. And what I mean by themes, there's themes and there's topics. Topics are, say, condom use. Themes are when a common theme that you hear is, I don't like to use condoms because of the feeling of skin-to-skin and intimacy issues, right? So that's a theme, is that condoms interfere with intimacy, where condom use might be your topic. So it has to convey some meaning, or as the example here, condoms in a main relationship are a sign of mistrust. And you can expand on that theme with some of the things you find out. So while I'm finishing up with this, think about any themes that you might have heard in the travel interview for the interviewers. And the other thing are taxonomies, or what Karen referred to earlier as typologies. What these are is these are valid categories within a content area. As with Karen's example, she talked about sex work, types of persons involved in sex work. She went through a couple of different types of sex workers, some that traveled to clients, some that worked in brothels, some that worked independently. You know, we did a study in Phoenix, Arizona, 17 years ago, and we had, when you start expanding these out, sometimes you're very surprised at how broad the typology gets. We must have had about a dozen different categories and several subcategories under a lot of that kind of thing. So another important thing that'll give you some interesting data, and like with Karen's, you can actually use it to sort of discover things about how relationships work, how a community functions. Okay. So what we're going to do as a group exercise is look at what kind of data the interviewers got. So I need a volunteer interviewer to come, or a note taker, if there was a note taker. First, we have a note taker. Second, interviewer, if there was no note taker, who also was the note taker. Somebody to come up and tell the story that they heard. Volunteers? Great.
We didn't do ours based on any kind of sex stuff.
Right. That's what we're doing that now. It's an artificial situation.
Did I do this interview wrong? But
it's okay.
We talked about one of the best places she'd ever gone on vacation was while she was on spring break at school. And she went to a Catholic university, and they went on an Indian reservation. And while she was there, she spent time working with the children, especially kids from 5 to 8. And one of the things she asked them was, what did they want to be when they grew up? And she said she saw a lot of blank faces. Like, she would expect others to say, well, I want to be a firefighter, or I want to be a policeman or a teacher. And since they didn't really have any answers, she noticed some characteristics that they had and was able to give them some ideas. Well, you're so good at showing people this, and that would make you a good teacher. And when we talked about the area where she was, she said when they got out of the car, the snow was really, really high, and the land was very flat, and you could see areas where the snow was plowed, and you could see areas where it wasn't. She said there was one area where the snow was above, starting to get so high that the water in the lake was like ready to go above the edge of the snow and across the road. And one of the other things that they did is they had a basketball team. And so they went to this big basketball game, and they went there to support these Native American kids. And they came in a red minivan. And everybody in the area had old vehicles. So when they saw the minivan, the people were like stroking it, checking it out, because it was so new and shiny.
Okay, great. Okay, so for those of you, the rest of you who have listened to that, any questions you'd want to ask our note taker? What's your name?
Cheryl.
So any questions you want to ask Cheryl? That was an interesting story. Should I start? Okay. You mentioned she. Who was she that told you the story? What can you tell me a little bit about her? Okay. So Michelle was doing a residency in what kind of residency?
At a Catholic university.
Medical residency?
A Jesuit.
Okay. Okay, anything else anybody wants to expand on? Questions? Yeah.
What reservation?
Okay. Well, we have a chance to validate. What reservation?
I can't remember the name of
it. Oh. On Devil's Lake, Wisconsin?
North Dakota.
And
Devil's Lake has changed its name, too. It was a
Sioux
reservation.
Okay. It's sort of on the tip of my tongue, but anyway. Any other? Okay, so I have a few comments on it. She talked to children who were 5 to 8.
These are facts.
These are facts, yeah. Ask questions about what they wanted to do when they grew up. Got responses like firefighter, police, teacher. She didn't get responses. Oh, see? Good. Validating. So giving them prompts, right. Okay. And then suggested things like, you're so good at sharing, you'd be a good teacher. That was one example. So that's more than a fact, actually. But we'll tease that apart later. Okay. And then she also mentioned about the snow being really high and the lake almost overflowing. A basketball game, and everyone went to support it. So some of those are facts, some of those are themes, some we might put together in a typology. Anything else anybody heard that they want to add to the list? The what? Okay. Yeah. I'm not sure. Well, she was telling a travel story. Yes, that might be leading, but it might not be if that's what you were going to go out and do the interview about. But since this wasn't really an interview, it was more an experience, you can do all the leading you want in your own travel. So. Great. Okay, let's do one more.
Well, I interviewed Mark, and we discussed his most efficient travel, which was when he went to Phoenix, Arizona. And while he was there, this is back when you could take leave in conjunction with traveling with CDC. Mm-hmm. So this was work, pleasure, nature, culture, all of that, as well as getting a lot of work done. So he went to Phoenix, Arizona in the mid-1990s, and while he was there, he was having a meeting with the Indian Health Service dealing with issues of Native American health. And they also discussed different things that could be done better, and it was a lot of interaction going on as well. While he was there, he drove 100 miles to the Grand Canyon, and he was in really good shape at the time, so he ran 10 miles into the canyon, and he also ran 10 miles back, and he could have did the entire thing, ran all the way to the river, but it was a huge sign that said, do not do this or you could die. So he decided not to do that, and afterwards he just afterwards he drove into the airport after going through the desert and everything, drove to the airport and went home. So that's all I have.
Okay, anything on that one? Any questions?
So we're asking additional
questions. Yeah. Yeah. Would you want to debrief? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Okay, so started at a meeting with a group, and then the travel was alone. Okay. Okay, let's do one more really quick. So we have a... Go ahead, Susan.
My person took a year off between high school and college because she was a bit burnt out in high school, and she went to Central and South America. And she went to Peru, Bolivia, Mexico, Guatemala, and Ecuador. She had studied Spanish since the second grade, but she didn't feel competent in it. So she was immediately, she stayed with an indigenous family. Not sure the first country. But for 3 months, and well, she stayed with them and she was sort of thrown into it. And then she felt like she was fluent after 3 months. But then she spent the rest of her time, she was there a year, kind of polishing the Spanish skills. She picked coffee on a coffee plantation in one country. In Guatemala, she taught English. In Ecuador, she lived on a commune that was run by two expats from Great Britain, but there were all these people from all over the world. And she felt that she learned how to be independent in this trip, and that sort of it renewed the sense of what she really wanted to do in life. She wasn't kind of confirmed that, and she is really interested in being a medical doctor. And she's gone on from this trip to be, she's a college student, and she's in social work, but pre-med. And that is that.
That's great, thanks. Okay, anybody want to debrief on that? Yeah.
No, she already knew.
Oh, she did.
She wanted to go into medicine, but this confirmed it.
Is that correct? Yeah.
Why Central and South America? Why did you decide on Central and South America?
I think it was because I had taken Spanish for so long, and I was kind of like, my parents were like, oh, you can't just bop around and travel for a year. You kind of have to do something that might be meaningful. And so I decided, well, okay, if I'm gonna take a year off and I'm gonna travel, I really want to go somewhere where I'm going to like learn on scale. So being thrown into that Spanish was really a good way to do it.
Okay, great. Okay, well, let's just keep moving on. So we looked at some facts. Karen's been writing down lots and lots of facts. How about any themes? Did anybody hear any themes? That's great. What did you say? Something about a purpose?
A renewed sense of purpose.
A renewed sense of purpose, right. Right, so travel experience gave a renewed sense of purpose. Anything else? Oh, hang on. Okay, do that again. Traveling for self-discovery. And what? How would you say that? An example of that?
Trying to determine what I'm like.
Right. Go ahead.
I would say there was a theme of interest in Latin America.
Okay, now that I would call more of a topic. Because it doesn't have as much meaning to it. It's just an interest in foreign cultures, where the others have some sort of deeper meaning. It, you know, it's self-discovery. It's I can't remember what the first one was.
Renewed sense of purpose.
Renewed sense of purpose, right. Where those convey some sort of, you know, feeling and cognitive meaning to you. Where the other is a topic that you might use for taxonomies in where people tend to go. So one is travel to South America, one is travel to Arizona. What I heard that was really interesting was through this travel I learned how to be independent. And that's just, I mean, it's rare, but sometimes you get a theme that just sort of slaps you in the face when people talk. It's really nice. And what you'd find, so what we're doing now sort of verbally, or what I'm doing, is what you would do with memoing. So if you have really, it's the kind of thing, you know, we're talking about analysis, and Karen mentioned there's software that'll actually help you do this, but you can actually do a lot of this in Word if you're, you know, if you're just doing it on your own and you're doing small amounts. So if you're in track changes and you're, you know, so say you've got all your interview notes on your paper, on your expanded, and you enter them all on a computer, and you've got them in Microsoft Word, you just go to track changes, and you start making comments on the side. Oh, this is a great theme here where she talks about independence. What a great theme here about renewed sense of purpose, or or thinking back to when you were in great shape and could walk 20 miles round trip up and down the Grand Canyon, or you still are, of course, but all those kind of things, you can put them in little memo notes. And then what will happen is, you know, we only had 3 interviews, but say you have, say, 20, which is a pretty good number to work with on a small rapid assessment. You'll start seeing some patterns. Even in this, we saw some patterns in that we had 2 of the 3 stories were about, I'd have to think about how you'd want to say it, but
they're all on a break,
but yeah. And, I mean, even Mark, he didn't go into it as much. Go ahead.
And it's like a reference on a time when they felt that there was a challenge, that there was a confidence there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we asked for what's your most memorable travel. So we're starting, this is really making a leap on an N of 2. But, you've got what makes travel memorable for at least a couple people is that it's about what, you know, their experiences learning from other people and working with other people. You know, so it's sort of the pleasure of actually working and helping and that sort of thing, which, you know, you'd think that would be an easy thing to find from people coming to this conference. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing where you can start to look at themes, you can start to look at taxonomies, you can look at patterns, and then the compelling quotes or statements is as you're writing things down. So, Susan, I don't know if you wrote down when she said about, I learned how to be independent, did you get that in a quote?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So.
I wasn't conscious to write the quotes, but I think I wrote it from her mouth.
Yes, yeah. So, and when you go back to expand, you'll recognize when you wrote down your thoughts versus when you wrote down exact words, and you can highlight some of those words so that for the next piece, when you're writing up a report, you know, you can put those quotes in because it's always nice to have those. Okay, so the last thing we're going to talk about is the idea of sort of reporting out, getting some sort of report. You know, one of the things is, what's the purpose of the assessment? Well, this was to just find out about some travel experiences and and in fact, we're going to modify our purpose because we've already found some information out. So we're going to say what makes travel memorable for this group of people at the conference, who's our little ethnography. So the first thing we want to do is state that purpose. Then we'd want to have like some background data. So when Karen or I or Thurka or any of the people who do rapid assessment, a lot of times what we'll start with is epi data. Okay, what's the problem? Let's describe the epidemiology, and what, you know, rates are going up, what rates are going down, what populations are affected, on and on and on. Okay, so you've got your epi data. For us, with this thing, what some of the background data that we could say about the travel exercise? Anybody got any background data? Our ethnography, look around, use your observation.
Like the area was no covered?
No, more about our exercise of interviewing people to find out about what makes a travel memorable. Are these people, who are these people that we're talking with? Right. So, to follow up on yesterday's plenary, they're born somewhere between 1930 and 1975. I'm thinking. So we've got sort of an age group, gender split, probably 60 to 70% women. You know, we've got lots of things that you could observe like that. So that could be part of your background is describing your population. Pretty educated population too, we think. Of course, I'm making an assumption, but I sort of have that feeling. So I might want to explore that and get that in my data. And I might want to, you know, hopefully I would have had some basic, even if you're doing qualitative work, you want to have some basic demographic information. So, okay, so. Yeah, the people that we heard from clearly said that, yeah. Yeah, so it's not a total just guess. And then what were our methods? Our methods were just really brief interviews, 3-minute interviews, asking a question about travel. Then what we want to do is look at our facts, themes, and taxonomies. We've just sort of gone through that kind of stuff. One thing about the quotes is, and you'll find this if you pick out, chances are if you pick out a few papers that are published with quotes, go look at the quotes and go read what people write about interpreting the quotes, and I bet if you take 3 qualitative papers, you're going to find at least one instance where the quote doesn't match what they're saying is happening. It's the easiest trap to fall into. It's close. I mean, you know, people don't just, you know, take one thing and just go off on a tangent, but they'll take the example and not quite say what it is because they're really interested in making another point and they were looking for a really good quote and, hey, this was the most compelling quote. So I'm going to put this really compelling quote in, but then I've still got this discussion I've got to make. So they just stay on the discussion. They're gone. So that's the one thing I would say is when you're if you, you know, get to the point where you're writing something up, to be very, very careful. Then the last thing you might want to do is make some recommendations or conclusions. I mean, my conclusion from this is that travel is more memorable when it has a purpose and relates to your life and helps you grow. But for something else, you might have recommendations. Okay. And I'll hand it over. Any questions that you want to ask before I hand it back over to Karen?
When you're starting your interview, I want to refer to the lead question that you mentioned. For example, you asked, how prevalent is sex work in this area? Suppose, for example, your respondent says, there is no sex work in this area. How do you proceed? Because in most cases, there are certain topics that might be a bit sensitive, and you are intruding into people's lives. I know you did mention much earlier that maybe you'll have spent some bit of time, but still people are a bit reserved in sharing certain pieces of information. Suppose you expected that to be like a starting point, and they shut you down completely. How do you continue? The second question I want to ask is, you also mentioned the importance of collecting data as an insider, all right? How do you make sure that when you get these observations and responses, you are not viewing them from your own perspective, and especially when you are dealing across different cultures? Because, you know, I might observe something which has got a completely different cultural meaning from what you observe. How do you take care of that?
Let me make a few comments, and then I might ask you to also chime in. For the first one, one thing that I meant to sort of slip in there that's really important is Karen mentioned that one of the key things about qualitative work and ethnographic research is that it's purposive. The first thing I would say is that you want good interviewees, and that you actually will choose people for their ability to tell you things or their, you know, their willingness to talk. So ideally you'll pick people who are more willing to talk. That doesn't mean that they won't still try to stonewall you on some topics. But you know, if you get into an interview where you're interviewing somebody and they answer every question with one or two words no matter what you do and probe, you need to cut your losses, be polite, finish the interview, and get out. And get on to somebody else who's actually going to tell you things, because it's not like a survey. You don't need every interview. You need the good ones. So, and part of the reason you do 20 to 30 interviews is so that you have a set of really good ones. The other thing is, and Karen already mentioned this, is you reframe that question at sort of on the fly. Instead of asking about that, you know, then you ask maybe a more general question about, if you were asking about risk for sex work, I can't remember exactly what your example was, but say you asked about what's the prevalence of sex work, and they said there is none, then you might want to back up and say, what's it like for single women in this country? What's their life like? Tell me about single women. And then sort of move into it. What kind of risks do they face? That sort of thing. And then for the second piece about the insider-outsider, there's a couple different ways to handle that. One is to recognize that you are an outsider and that your perceptions will be different. And there are certain benefits to this because you're going to see some obvious things that an insider might not see, like the example of the cotton in the transmission of disease. It's not because the people using IV drugs weren't smart enough to realize that this was a source of disease because they were trying to control disease. It was that it's so much a part of their automatic functioning, they don't see it. So you need that outsider's point of view. So that's, you sort of get the good with the bad. Outsiders can also misunderstand things. There's a great book, and I can't remember where it is, about some of the lies anthropologists believed, including one about all the bald. Why are there no bald men here? Well, we send all the bald men over to that island over there, and they actually wrote it up in their report that all the bald men are sent over to the island across the bay. But you know, one of the other ways to do it is to train insider interviewers so that you get both, so that you have some insider interviewers and some outsider interviewers. So you get that benefit of somebody from the outside looking for the obvious and the benefit of an insider saying, what do you mean there's no sex work here? What about blah, 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 blah on that street over there and what goes on? So, you know, you can get that combination. And validating, as we said, like we did, you know, going right back to the participant and saying, well, why were you there? What reservation was it? Those kind of things.
I mean, I think I agree with everything that Fred said, and I think there are other ways to ask the question. We did get several respondents who did say, you know, we don't really know anything. I don't really know very much about it. So we tried to reframe the question in different ways. You know, we know that you work with a lot of farm workers in this area. Do they ever tell you anything about perhaps some of the women that come to the camps? You know, certain things like that. There are other ways to reframe it, and that got people talking. One of the things that you really want to be comfortable with when you do ethnographic interviewing, which I didn't mention, is that you really need to be comfortable with silence. Oftentimes when in quantitative interviews or in surveys, you just keep asking questions. You just keep throwing questions. You don't give people enough time to really reflect, to really think. And so you want to be very comfortable with silence, because don't take that as that they don't know, but to really sort of understand that they're really kind of processing and thinking through things. And I think people tend to be very responsive if you try to reframe things in a different way, perhaps in a way that they are able to sort of not see it as stigmatizing or as taboo of a subject as they originally did when you asked the question. So I think that's the only thing I want to say. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. Before we wrap up, I just want to say this has been a really quick and dirty run through of, you know, just giving a quick introduction to rapid assessment and the approach. There are a couple of topics that we didn't really touch on as much as we would like to. We need another hour to talk about more in depth about sampling, more in depth about field work. We did not mention saturation. I know for those of you that are qualitative researchers, you know what that is, but that's also an important concept. I want to mention a couple of things. One is, don't often make book recommendations, but this is a very, and there are a couple of slides at the end of the presentation that have a lot of resources. This is a good resource on rapid assessment. It's a book by James Beebe. It's very practical, user-friendly. The presentations, I think, are going to be posted, but we can also send them to you. We have our contact information on the slide. There are also a bunch of websites, the WHO, UNHCR, High Commission on Refugees, and UNAIDS all have. And I've got a link on the slide to the one, I think it's called the WHO, Jesse, you might know, it's the Rapid Assessment and Response Technical Guide, I think is what it's called. But resources on rapid assessment. Another good resource beyond those of us at CDC are your local anthropology and sociology departments, particularly anthropology departments. You usually have people that know how to do qualitative research, and often there are people who have used this approach and methodology. There are some manuals and curricula out there. The IRIR has a curriculum that if you contact me, I can tell you more about that. We also at CDC have been working on a draft guidelines document for conducting rapid assessment, so that is still in the works in draft form, but we'll be working on it. But in the meantime, there are lots of other resources, and you know, you can feel free to call us, email us, and ask any questions. If there are no other questions, I want to thank everyone for coming. I'm sure there's a lot of knowledge in this room. Also, just finally, I want to let you know, this is actually the first time we've done presentations on rapid assessment. This is the first time where we've had three people doing this and tried to incorporate some exercises in this way. So if you have feedback for us, we'd like to do more of this. We'd like to do workshops. Feel free to email us and let us know what you thought worked, didn't work, you know, what we need to add or get rid of. So thanks a lot for coming. There are also some materials up here in front, just some papers, two-pager on CDC technical assistance related to rapid assessment. So feel free to take any of those, and then, you know, as we said, we'll send out materials too. So thank you.